Good evening, everyone. Great pleasure to see you tonight. It's hot. Summer has come. It's my great pleasure to introduce Peter Lester, who's the young boy at the back, and Dexter McGee, the younger one in the front. Now, both men are locals. Both have followed their passion into environmental health throughout their lives. In Peter's case, a huge interest in soil from his 20s on, and Dexter following the importance of healthy water supplies throughout his science career. Now, Peter was awarded a scholarship to the USA in 1968. Over the next 10 years or so, Peter studied under soil scientists in Ohio, Colorado, and Texas. He returned to New Zealand and has his own consultancy service, his main practice in laboratories, receiving samples worldwide, is established in Waipawa, from which he has recently retired. Peter holds an honorary doctorate in animal nutrition. He is commonly known simply as Dr. Dirt. Welcome, Dr. Dirt. Dexter attained a degree in applied science, specializing in chemistry and biochemistry. He has lectured and worked as a research technician at Massey. Oversaw a comprehensive study of Taranaki's waterways in 1981. He also worked with a colleague, John Stark. A worldwide index was developed and established at this point, the John Stark Index. I hope you have a minute to describe that tonight, Dexter. He is a local landowner and acutely aware of how things have changed. So tonight, as you know, this year, the perfect storm happened. What relationship exists between soils, waterways, and animals is hopefully to be exposed to all of us by an inquiry with, hopefully, the best scientists available, because that is where the answers are best determined. Water is so important that an expert's opinion this morning stressed that it had to be taken out of politicians' hands entirely. Time will tell that one. So, ladies and gentlemen, the first half will be a PowerPoint demonstration with Peter explaining his work in soil science, and Dexter will be here especially to answer questions on water. So thank you very much, gentlemen.
I had a laboratory in Waipawa. We've since sold that to my business partner, and now I'm supposed to be retired, but I seem to be doing more work than I did before. Now, as far as soil science is concerned, I did soil science and I also did animal nutrition under Tim Mason in Texas and to Bob Scott. Now, Bob Scott was out here last year. He cried because he said, "You're my favourite student," and he had to go back to America. I said, "Bob, you can't stay unless you've made application first." Poor old fella got off the plane at the other end and died. So, dear old fella, he was my favourite tutor. Now, he taught me in animal nutrition. He was a vet by trade in Colorado, and I met him in 1968, and if you go to our web page, you'll see a testimonial. I think it's a bit overdone, but this is how good a guy I was. People have used a lot of chemicals to control weeds. Well, all you got to do is change the chemistry of the soil. That's the plant's rumen, and you'll change the species. That's ragwort, and that's how that farm was. When the bank were going to sell the guy up, and he came to me, and I salvaged his father's farm years before. His father did a first OE to England, slipped off the plane at Heathrow and died. So he left it to David, and David came to me, "Can you help me like you helped my dad?" So we said to the bank, "Well, just give us 3 to 5 years." They said, "Yes, we'll do that." And 5 weeks later, they decided to pull the mayor out from under them. So we then challenged the bank with a QC and said, "Okay, we'll take you to court and we'll fight this." And they rang me about 10 o'clock on a Wednesday night and said, "If you can refinance, we'll drop $1 million off the mortgage." I said, "You've already had your $1 million. You sold them up on the first one for $4 million. You put that in your pocket, and now you finance them again another $5 million in another place." So we just changed the fertility based on nitrogen and phosphate from that to that only in 11 months, from there to there. And it's never grown any ragwort since. But its production that year went up 77.8%. And it's maintained around about 80% ever since it increases. So they're friends of mine, obviously, now. Now, I don't take any wages for it or anything else. I made this up years ago to show you how much land we're actually living on. That little portion, 95% of all human beings live on that little wee piece of land, and now we're stuffing it up. And this water problem was prompted me to write an article on it, and I said, it's crazy. The amount of nitrogen we're using at present is ludicrous. We shouldn't have to buy nitrogen. The atmosphere is 78% nitrogen. All we've got to do is get the nitrogen re-established again. It'll produce its own. What we're doing with nitrogen is like blowing up a balloon. We've got the same amount of tissue spread over a larger and larger surface area and a thinner membrane. Then consumes that defecator urinate because it's got the toxins in its system. So don't blame the cow. Blame the guy that did it. Now, they don't blame the farmers either, because the farmers see that as more grass, but it's not more grass, more slush. But we have to get that back right again. And the essential found 17 essential elements for plant growth. And just as long, Livy was a German chemist, and he devised the law of minimum back in the 1840s. And he said the growth would be proportionate to the most limiting factor. And so if you're not NPK, and I actually lectured in America once, and I said to the students, do you know what NPK stands for? I put a circle up, an N for our nitrogen, a P for our phosphate, and K for our carbohydrates and whatever we produce from our potassium. And they all said, yes, we know it stands for. Well, I said, well, I'll tell you what it stands for. Non-profit kingdom, that's what it stands for. Because if it's cobalt deficiency required by the animal by 1/10 to 1 part per million, if it's not there, the animal dies. It's that simple. We've got all the other elements also involved as well. And when we test in our laboratory, well, it's not my laboratory anymore now, but when they test in the laboratory, we test the whole 16 elements and find out which one is limiting. Then you give you a prescription to fix that. And now on the animal nutrition, we have an artificial rumen there. We put the feed through and it's digested like the animal would do. We found what the animal could or couldn't get out of that and give you a recipe to rectify that. And one of the problems in New Zealand is we're carbohydrate short, we're energy short in New Zealand. We're protein rich and we're one of the few countries in the world. And this high protein, and they put nitrogen on, and they produce a lot more crude protein. And the animal is under stress for that, and then we've got our eczema coming in and all the other problems that are associated with that. Now eczema, I've sold eczema, and eczema is actually a vitamin A deficiency, and it's not an eczema at all. It's a photosensitivity, because vitamin A is converted from beta-carotene in the plant to be vitamin A, and because we've got too much non-protein nitrogen, that protein hooks on the end of the molecule and it can't pass through the intestinal wall. And so the animal starves for vitamin A. Vitamin A deficiency will give you the same symptoms as we so-called eczema. So we fixed that. Well, we've got bloats, is another one we fixed, just by getting the protein back right again so they don't explode when they hit the rumen, so you don't get bloat. We've got foot rot solved. We've got all these things, solved them, but we did some research at Massey University at Grasslands 3 years ago, and we got 88.2% reduction and ammonia in the rumen. And then they said, oh, we'll have to do a 5-year research and document this. We went to do the research and the fertilizer industry came in. They said that research is not to be done on that farm. So they just stifled it straight away. So we'd soil tested it, we had all the fertilizer ready to go on, it wasn't to go on. So the whole system is run by vested interest. Yeah, I'm not a friend of the fertilizer company, that's understandable. They don't like me and I don't like them. But we've got a company in Mount Maunganui that mixes our mixers for us. Well, not my mixers, whatever. So we can get it delivered to their farm unbiasedly. Yeah. Now, as I say, this is the carbon and the nitrogen. You've got the carbon cycle on the right-hand side there and the nitrogen cycle. They're interlinked. You can't boost one without destroying the other. That's the only way the system works. And so they get this massive increase in growth and this destruction. The nitrogen cycle, and if you increase the nitrogen cycle, you automatically decrease the carbon cycle. Research has shown that 1 kilogram of excess nitrogen will stimulate enough bacteria to destroy 100 kilograms of humus. So it's a big mining operation, and we wonder why we get pollution in the rivers. And all this burning off of the carbon and all this attached to it is then really leaching. Now, people say we can't put your fertiliser on, it's going to leach when it rains. Well, if that's the case, the west coast wouldn't be the most barren part of New Zealand. We never stopped raining there. But it's the most prolific growth we have in New Zealand. So the Creator in His wisdom made that little soil particle, what we call a colloidal particle. is negatively charged and attached to its surfaces of positive charge elements, calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium, iron, manganese, copper, zinc, cobalt, electrolyte, are attached there, and the plant has to buy them. It uses a water molecule, and the element of the atom manganese, which is one of the rare elements, it splits the water molecule into hydrogen and hydroxyl. Now, one of my latest thesis was on manganese, and it's the most critical element in what we call the Krebs cycle. It's the most critical element. It's the first element in the Krebs cycle to start the whole process running. The next one. That's the ordinary NPK philosophy, and we say, well, there's all there. If you don't test those, you don't know what's going to happen. As I say, cobalt efficiency, 1/10 to 1 part per million without the animal dies. It's that simple. Doesn't matter how much food you put on the table, if the essential ingredients are not in it, you're going to die. Starvation is not keeping your food away, it's keeping an essential animal away. Some of our soil tests are a bit hard to understand, but we tested all the elements there, we give a design depending on the plant species you're growing, and the value found that the excessive deficiency, that then we say, okay, that's where it should have been, that's 100% of its requirement, and that's the percentage of the requirement we actually found. And then we'll make them up, the farmer up, a recipe to fix that again. Well, it is a recipe, that's gone off to the fertilizer people to do the mix, and we say that's a ton, and that's what we want in that ton. Actually, we did that one at Massey University. We took an NPK farm, and right next to it was one of our farms. And we showed the difference, and it was astronomical difference in the soils. And there we are. That's farm sample of one of our herbage tests, but that's pretty involved. When we go through and we do crude protein, digestible protein, metabolizable protein, right through the whole thing into the vitamins and minerals. We found by balancing that back up again, this is a chart of milk, urea, nitrogen level. That's where it should have been, and that's what we got. And we were actually quite optimum there. There was no excess bleeding off out of that again. And the next one, all of a sudden, it goes inefficient. And that's just across through the fence, actually. Straight through the fence, and the mud level dropped way down here. Sorry, the mud level, the milk, urea, nitrogen shot through the roof, and the animal had to urinate, had to defecate to get rid of that or die. So it's just that simple. And of course, they don't look at that. They say, oh, well, I mean, the animal's urinating, defecating, get rid of the animal. All you've got to do is feed them right in the first place. You haven't got the problem. That actually is just across here, not far from here. We've got an optimal level on that one, and he's doing some research in, well, I can't remember now what research is doing, but he's the highest implants in the world on his property. He came out towards Hastings, he came to the first roundabout, turned left, he's just on the left in there, just past the school. Now there's the research that was done at Massey, and this is done by Dr. Stefan Mertzel, he's a German, and showed the amount of conversion we had here, the amount of fermentable carbohydrates on this one that shot through the roof. And he said, well, we have to do the research now to prove why this is happening, because this is fantastic. We're not getting any bleed off on this animal, but we're getting a massive amount of defecation on that one. So we set up the trials, and we had it all ready to run, and the guy from Lincoln University that's in charge of Ravens now said, no, it's not happening. And that was the recipe. This is two farms side by side. They became a client of ours. Now this one here got an increase of production by 24%, and this one actually got a decrease of 9.1%. So just changing the feed and changing the soils. And that's just a nitrogen utilization efficiency. That's the same old chart again. It's there. I think there's another one there. The client's last pickup of last year, the very end of the pickup, he had a 77.8% increase over the previous year. And everyone was screaming drought and all the rest of the problems. And he said, it doesn't happen to me. I don't have the problem yet. So I set the company up 40 odd years ago. We sell nothing. They're completely, entirely independent of everyone. That's why they hate my guts. If they could mow me down tomorrow, they would. I think they clapped like mad when I had a bad heart attack. I think four now. I had one in Tasmania a few years ago and ended up in the Artrobe Hospital, and they wouldn't let me fly out 4 months, so I had to sit over there for 4 months. So this is the fourth one I've had. But anyhow, let Dexter have something to say here. Please, Dexter.
Well, at least I can stand on my feet today, which is good. Well, my background is that I've had quite a lot to do with farming, and family's been involved in farming pretty much since the time I arrived in New Zealand. My great-grandmother was the first European woman in Wellington, so that's going back a while, 1840. It has concerned me, a lack of concern about environment around here.
We've been doing a lot of damage in the way that we've been rerouting waterways. We have little concern for our farming and horticultural practices show little regard for the fact that what we spray onto trees, going to soils, generally works its way either through the food or through the animals of which we eat, either the animals or the food directly. And the half-life for a lot of these materials is quite, you know, a long time. I was even concerned a while ago. I looked at these soil analyses and they were picking up radiation. I thought, what are we looking at radiation for? And of course, for many years, we had all these bombs released in Australia and up north of New Zealand, and a lot of this stuff worked its way down here, often via the fertilizer that we bought in the way of Christmas Island. And of course, I think a lot of these fertilizer companies realize, in fact, that they spread this radioactive material over just about every farm in New Zealand. Of course, that enters our waterways and what have you too. But my more immediate concern has been after this outbreak of Campylobacter, probably other things too, but that's at least one thing that was identified. I'm not a microbiologist, so I have done some microbiology as part of my studies in the past. My concern is the pesticide residues and Campylobacter or whatever, Cryptosporidium, Giardia, a whole range of organisms that can get into our water supplies. What I've noticed on my farm, I used to have a lovely, beautiful stream, and over the years, the regional council and the catchment board prior to that had the idea that they should deepen all these channels in order to get deep rooting for the trees that were about to be planted there. Problem is, the stream that I used to have no longer flows for 10 months of the year at all. There used to be 31 springs on the base of the stream, and they're all very surface drainage type streams, like exist all around the bay here, or did exist all around the bay here. And they've dug deep down, and often they've tapped out those springs into main deep channels. And after this event most recently, we had only 54% of the normal winter rainfall, and we got this big flow of rain thereafter. And of course, all these spring orifices now work in reverse, so the water just comes along and goes straight down into our drinking water. And the point is, at the moment, we've only identified these microorganisms, but I think long term, the pesticide, herbicide residues are the things we're really going to have to worry about. I've spent many years doing water analysis. I worked in the New Plymouth Power Station for 3 years, looking at all the water coming into the power station. We had to have that of a very, very high standard. We were measuring things in parts per billion. For instance, silica in the water, you wouldn't even think of, will deposit on the turbine blades, and if it deposits unevenly, it will simply blow the turbines apart from balance. So I looked at all the water chemistry of the waters and fuels and oils and various things in there. I've also worked in the fertilizer industry, and I worked for the Taranaki Catchment Commission, surveying all the rivers there for their water quality. That was prior to the gasoline plants and petrochemical industry starting up. And that goes back a long time. I did my first water analysis 42 years ago, so that goes back quite some time. And I've worked chemistry methods right through to modern technology of today. I worked at Massey University in engineering and technology, working on water research projects and what have you there. So yeah, I've had quite a wide range of work, both from a practical and theoretical point of view, so I understand most sides of the argument. I wouldn't say we always understand all sides of the argument. I was just thinking of Peter's situation, talking about nitrogen. During World War II, when they went to land aircraft up there in the jungles, they couldn't land them, so they injected anhydrous ammonia into the soil to burn up all the carbon. And that compacted the soil so that they could land the aircraft. And of course, you're putting stuff onto the soils and what have you, and all the carbon's burnt out of it. It's as hard as rock. And the Americans went back to the States and did the same thing over there. And that anhydrous ammonia meant that the soils they treated had brilliant growth for a short period of time for nitrogen supply, but thereafter they couldn't pull a plow through it, became that hard. And of course, that indicates that you can't get penetration into the soil to process anything on it. So most of the toxic things that go into the ground can be processed in the soil if there's something there to process with it to a certain extent. but of course the residual gets down into our underground aquifers. Eventually, and there's no such thing as a confined aquifer because we're dealing with so much seismic movement around here and drilling of oil wells, test bores and old bores. One way or the other, you've got entry to those aquifers. I've recently written a report for David Parker for Parliament relating to this, and I won't disclose all the stuff that I've put in that. It's back in my mind as to what I've written in regard to our recent bacterial outbreak. I'd rather take some questions if we could.
Thanks, guys. You got through in good time. We want questions tonight.
What is the anhydrous ammonia?
It's a form of ammonia that's without water in it, if you like. Like ammonium hydroxide.
Highly concentrated. It's about 90% nitrogen.
There's nasty things to get in the water. But is there any way that they can get out once they're in?
Well, basically, is it possible to decontaminate water once it is contaminated? Well, it can be, but it's usually very expensive. For instance, you can use cation and anion exchange columns to take out heavy metals and things like that. And filters of various kinds, activated charcoal will take out most organic substances, and you have your own little supply at home to do this. But ultimately, it comes to a situation where it becomes uneconomic. We've got a situation now where we've largely got not too bad water, but what's the point of destroying our water supply at the other end and saying things are uneconomic to do things in such a way as not to contaminate the environment and yet later on come back and have to address the issue in a more uneconomic fashion?
I mean, would nature do anything on its own accord?
Sure it does. I mean, I think streptomycin, everyone knows the antibiotic, well, that was first got from a soil fungi in 1947. So the soil, with it sort of treated rightly and without excessive contaminants put on it, it has the capacity to process most things. But around in Hawke's Bay, for instance, over the years, we have put copper oxychloride on trees. And the end result of that is now, if you put lambs on orchards here for too long, they die of copper poisoning. These are issues that are real. The trouble with chemistry is often you can't see what's there. We walk around every day and we make observations about what we can visually observe, but I've had chemical training. I trained as an analytical chemist, and I went into clinical biochemistry, and I've got quite a range of knowledge in various areas of this sort of thing. But unless you've had some training in these areas, you're kind of oblivious. It's like walking around with your eyes closed, even for the sighted, if you see what I mean. You have to have some background in some of these areas in order to be able to have some appreciation for the consequences of actions, which just by a casual observation, you would think that there was no issue at all.
This question for Peter. Would dicalcic phosphate get a tick from you?
This is dead removed from superphosphate, but it's probably an expensive way of buying phosphate and lime, but it still doesn't cover all those. I mean, you look at 16, 17 essential elements, and if there's a copper deficiency and you put dicalcium phosphate on, it's not going to fix the copper deficiency. So it is better than super, but it's probably a little expensive for what you're buying. You know, that was very good of old Joe Top to come up with that, but there's more to soil fertility. And as is the dextrose covering on the nitrogen, and nitrate poisoning in New Zealand is becoming a major, major problem. And I spoke at Te Puke a few months ago, and there's a guy from the Waikato there who was from the Department of Agriculture. And I said, what are the nitrate levels there? He was talking about a little swamp. And I said, well, hold on a second. Most of the farmers are from the hinterland, not from the swamp. You can't use nitrogen on there because they're all from pumice country. I said, what about all the nitrate problems you've got in the rivers and in the Waikato? He said, oh, they're not too bad. They're just slightly above the World Health Organization. And there's only one child died last year with it. And I said, was it your child? He said, no. I said, well, if one died, there was another 10,000 behind it with subclinical nitrate poisoning. So I said, we don't realize what we're doing.
For those of you who are not aware of it, nitrate, NO3 minus the anion, attaches itself to the hemoglobin in the blood, and that stops oxygen uptake, and you end up with methemoglobinemia, which is a form of blue baby syndrome, and so it can cause permanent brain damage in children. Particularly, I was working as an analytical chemist in Auckland, and this firm, I won't mention who they were, but they were actually being asked by the dairy industry to use some an anion exchange column to extract the nitrates out of the milk powder so that, you know, children's milk powder wasn't contaminated to a level that would be dangerous for them.
There was an interesting report in the paper yesterday about a researcher in Auckland looking at lead in backyard chickens. Mm-hmm. they found 10 times the allowable limit in chickens and 4 times the allowable limit in their eggs. Do you think that's a more widespread problem?
Well, it could well be. I actually did some research work, which is in the massive library, on lead shot and farm dams. I was concerned about a farm dam that I used to have. There'd been a lot of shooting done on it, and I had thought that the lead shot might poison the water. I checked out probably about 26 different dam sites in other places, but I calculated out it would take 136 years to kill an animal from drinking that water. But there were other factors that could have come into play on that. Superphosphate is called fluorapatite, which means that it's got fluoride in it, ironically. It probably got cheap with very good teeth here. But anyway, lead fluoride is very soluble, so I figured in my mind that that drainage of that fluoride into the farm dams may in fact enhance that level of lead that is in the water. So in some cases, there is potential possibility that in fact that water could get to a toxic level. And my calculations were based on a 2% uptake in the alimentary canal of the animal drinking the water, which might not be correct. So 136 years might be brought down to 4 or 5 or something. So I don't know.
The thing is, I want to call it nitrates. Nitrates is odorless, tasteless, and colourless. You don't know it's there until it hits you on the back of the head. Then all hell breaks loose. And it's a problem. I was in the Midwest. I studied in the Midwest in America. I went back there about 8 or 9 years ago and bought a Cadillac car back. But the area which I was in was Iowa, and that's their corn-growing area. And back in 1975, the organic matter levels had dropped from 32 down to 5%. And I went back there 5 years ago when I bought the Cadillac, and it's down to 0.5%. And I said to Bill Glanzer, the guy showed me around, I said, either fix this, keep doing what you're doing, and then go on these to the Arabs and buy camels, because you're going to have one bloody big desert here shortly. And they're putting weed mat between the roads to stop the erosion. I said, surely you wake up, you're doing something wrong. And that's the food bowl of the world. 72 million acres of corn.
I've got a question about Campylobacter. What's known between the shallow aquifers and the deeper ones, and contamination between the two of them?
Well, I think a lot of what has been said about the aquifers, I don't think we've got enough knowledge of what's down here to give accurate indications, particularly the fact that we're constantly got seismic movement around here, and what we do one year is not necessarily what's going to be the same next year. And for the scientific reports, they often take several years to pump through, so even when last work was done, you can't rely on that as being fact. And what I thought, the water that was collected in the Campylobacter identified, water has a fingerprint. Every water source, you can identify it as being from a source based on its cations, anions, and other parameters like electrical conductivity. For those of you a bit more scientifically connected, that's the reciprocal of the ohm, one upon the ohm. It's measured in microsiemens per centimeter. So that's a common measure to determine the higher the electrical conductivity of waters or anything, in fact, the more dissolved salts are present, and it's even used in milking machines to pick up mastitis and stuff like that these days. But yeah, it would seem to me if got those samples that they got the bacterial analysis done on and analyzed them chemically and biochemically, it should be possible to identify the actual source, the original source of that water, done in a proper manner. But up to my knowledge, that hasn't been done.
We did some of the waters in Lochinvar Station, and they were actually coming from Lake Taupo, which is 800 feet below. It was pumped right up into there, and they just went to radioisotope cylinder and measured it and came out. And like,
you can use dyes like rhodamine T, rhodamine WT are quite common ones, and fluorescein and a few other things that mildly radioactive isotopes that you can trace around, like the iodine and what have you.
So how much confidence would you have when they bring in the big boys to do this inquiry?
Probably not a great deal, to be perfectly honest, because I've had interaction with the regional council in the past, and they ignore you. To acknowledge what you're saying is to give it some validity, and this is the issue.
That's changed.
Well, I do hope so.
Surely you'd have to know the composition of all the places where it possibly could come to, wouldn't you?
Yes, exactly, but there are so many different parameters there together, you should be able to identify it. It's a bit like a lottery ticket. You get one number right, you're not going to win the lotto, but you know if you've got about 8 out of 10 of them, you're getting close, and eventually if you get the other two, you're there. It's a bit like that, really. And the chances of you getting the right answer, the more parameters that fall in line. And if you get enough samples from enough different points, you could even do some maths as to what the dilution rates were, knowing the volumes of flow that you've got at various points and stuff like that.
You know how the riverbeds change after floods? Could that be happening underground?
Oh, absolutely. Along with seismic movement, I'm sure it's happening all the time. The problem I see, I know over at Napier Boys High School where they've been digging these big trenches, I know a while ago they were trying to put some foundations in for a classroom. They dug a hole and just watered it and plonk, and they're draining all that area over there, so the hydraulic effect of the removal of that water could result in all those buildings crumbling in due course. But of course, these things happen after people have had a serious think about what might, we don't really go into things in any depth. It's like the building of this dam. It's just a right, we'll build a dam, but they're not really going into the deep potential problems that may come about, Sure, we need some water there, but the cost of reticulation and the chances of contamination along the lines of those water sources could be real problematic.
We've been told the flushing flows are going to keep everything hunky-dory, but if you have a large dry spill, and flush the water down, you've got cracked ground, you're going to flush all the poo in front of it, and that will go down the cracks, and then the clean water will follow afterwards.
Yeah.
If they test it 3 days later, they'll say it's great.
Well, we've got these aquifers, and of recent, we've been taking out huge quantities. I go down to the Tennant Road part of the Tukituki River virtually every night with my dogs. And during the end of summer, after the massive withdrawal, seawater was apparently coming up as far as Tennant Road. Seawater will go underneath freshwater because it's more dense. Similarly, in these aquifers, supposedly confined aquifers, but in aquifers, you'll have a stratification of the water. They say that the water deep down there is about 49 years old. So, whatever's in that water probably relates back to what practices were back then. But water is its most dense at 4 degrees centigrade, so it goes to the very bottom. I'm not sure if you know about autumn turnover. There's a breakdown in water bodies that are able to be heated. End of summer, autumn, you get the thermal stratification breakdown, and in Wellington Harbour each year you get this black sulphide coming to the surface, maybe every year or second year. When the thermal stratification breaks down, the whole thing starts to mix. But before that stratification breaks down, everything stays separate, until the temperature comes up to a level where it starts to mix. So my theory as to what's possibly happened in our aquifers here, we've had this massive recharge of the aquifer after this rain, and this body on the top of the aquifer has been siphoned off for drinking water, and I think that's where our contamination has come from. It's just slid across from one part of the aquifer to the other, just on the surface as a separate entity, rather than mixing with the main body of water because of the different temperatures, because it would be quite warm, that water coming in at the top, as compared to what's already in there.
Briefly explain again the difference between what a big company recommends to a farmer and what you recommend. Are you actually treating the animal rather than the soil?
Well, yeah, the soil is the plant's rumen. It has no digestive system. The soil is its rumen. So we're feeding bacteria there. When the animal eats the grass, it's feeding bacteria in its rumen. So we're feeding bacteria all the way through. So, yeah, my philosophy is eons apart from the fertilizer industry. The trouble is with nitrogen, they make over 400% profit out of it because it's got from the atmosphere, the heat and temperature's got from Kapuni, and they use that and squeeze it together, make pills of nitrogen and flog it back to you. But we don't have to buy nitrogen. Nitrogen's not something you buy, but they make a lot of money out of it, so they sell it. And just coming here this evening, there was a truck and trailer load going Central Hawke's Bay way somewhere that are just big ton bags of nitrogen on it. There must have been 40 bags on it. It's sacrilege, really, because someone's going to have to pay for it. Whether it's you or your grandkids or the great-grandkids, someone's going to have to pay. You can't use nitrogen like that. It's not something you buy out of the bag. You get natural nitrogen cycle re-established again, which the Creator established millions of years ago, been working perfectly, haven't had the pollution problems, and they blame the animals But in the Midwest in America where I did my agronomy, the bison there were herds and herds of bison. They knocked them out to try to knock the income out for the Indians. But they were the, and the same in Africa. I spent a bit of time in Kenya and all the animals in Kenya and all through that African continent. They've actually decreased now by about 80% to what they used to be. But they didn't have a pollution problem. The whole thing will roll over itself as long as it's given the chance to do so. It's when man comes in with his hungry hand and he says, I can make money out of this, that's when it turns a custom, every time.
I just have a concern. I grew up here with my mother and my family, all telling me and Maori generally believing we lived on the most fertile land in New Zealand, probably in the world. What concerns me is the amount of land on the Heritage Plains that has been taken up with housing and concrete and building and whatever. And, I mean, once the buildings are on it, can we ever get it back again? Those soils?
It's hard. They can get it back. In fact, we're doing some research. We do some work with the forestry now and re-establish those forestry farms up on the central paddock. And it's hard to, but you can get it back, but it's going to take a while. But when you've got concrete, it's a bit harder to digest in pine trees. That's the major problem. And I've written a little book called Down to Earth. I'm getting a reprint done now. Put your name and address down. A good lady here will take it, then I can send you a copy of it. But I said at the very beginning of it, it's dollar-driven dogma. It's not science anymore. It's how much money can I make out of you? How can I get out of your pocket and into mine? And that's where the whole problem is, I think. Just the dollar, if you can take the dollar out of the system, it would be right, but everyone's hungry for more dollars.
Can you tell me, in this alleged contamination, is it Campylobacter or is it E. coli?
E. coli is used as an indicator species, if you like, for other pathogens like Campylobacter. Normally, E. coli only lasts about 48 hours out of the human gut or animal gut, so if you're getting high levels of it, it indicates a fairly recent contamination. So yeah, it's just an indicator species. But E. coli on its own, there's a whole lot of different types of E. coli. Some can actually even exchange genetics between one another. They can send out a thing and shoot a bit of DNA over to another one and transfer some genes to that. So some of the varieties of E. coli are extremely toxic.
Can you tell me then, could you guarantee that most of us here who've got a rubbish tin under our sink, that it won't have been contaminated?
Well, I'm just wondering about the context of that rubbish bin. What are you saying is in that rubbish bin?
The normal household rubbish that's been standing there in a bin that's been standing out on the street for a while.
Well, unless it's had some fecal contamination on, there shouldn't be too much E. coli around. I mean, E. coli floats around in the atmosphere and will drop on things, you know. That's why in your house, I think there's building regulations where there must be two doors between your toilet and your kitchen and stuff like that.
Why should the whole area, and New Zealand in particular as a nation, be being held up around the world as the worst case of E. coli, whatever it might be, in existence, and we can't even tell whether it is or what it's not? And how long it's likely to stay? You say yourself it stays for 48 hours, it's gone.
Sounds like politics to me.
Well, it's like radiation. There's a background level there all the time. You can't run away from it, you know. I think it's probably there to sell a few newspapers.
Exactly, and why should we put up with that?
We were doing the waters at Techo. We did the waters for our laboratory, and we found very high bacteria in the waters of Tekekino. We traced it back, and about four farms back, they had five offal pits, and that went down in the waterway, and that was just drifting straight through the...
And no doubt they were dragging their house water from it.
They were. They've
got a problem.
Yeah, well, they had problems, right? They had dysentery and all the rest of the problems. You'd have to check back here and find where this coming from, really.
Well, how does everybody else that doesn't just depend on our artesian supplies with the cattle and the sheep walking over their stream inlets? I haven't heard them complaining about E. coli and Campylobacter or whatever it might be, if it's one or the other.
Well, I think also a lot of the rural people have been exposed to so many high levels of... It's an immunity factor there as well coming into it, I think. In America, there's people with allergies left, right and centre, but if people have come off farms, they seldom get allergies. Allergies come about in later life as a result of not being exposed to high levels of environmental bacteria and viruses and whatever earlier on.
Precisely. You go to Nepal or somewhere and we all get yellow belly or something. Listen to Joy, how we've got the worst polluted rivers in the world.
Maybe proportionate to population, you might be right, but...
I think we need to get a bit of reality in this thing.
I think our pollution problem has been overemphasised, but we're not really getting back to the nitty-gritties of what caused it in the first place.
And if you're putting urea on, you're causing massive problems. And massive problems down the line that it come back and hit you in the back of the head, you won't know where it's come from.
There is a major problem, but it's just acknowledging that there is a problem and what the cause of that problem
where,
was.
Where are the problems?
Once upon a time, we used to be able to drink our water from the streams quite...
We still are.
I was going to bring up one issue about tourism and the fact that we've got people defecating near our river bodies, foreigners. And I'll give you an instance. I'm not sure if anyone has ever heard of Cysticercus bovis. It's a beef measles. You can get sheep measles as well, that's Cysticercus ovis. But they had a German tourist staying at some house down in Dannebrog area, and we got, I think, a first case of Cysticercus bovis in a heart, I think, in the freezing works. And they thought, well, where's this come from? It's part of a tapeworm life cycle involving the human rather than the dog, like Heidelitz. But anyway, they were able to trace this contamination back to this German tourist staying at this place that had gone through the septic tank system and out and through the animal. So, you know, this tourism thing is great from some, you know, immediate cash in the hand, but the ongoing consequences could be difficult. It's like when New Zealand was first settled, they used to leave ships out at sea for 3 weeks sometimes before they were even brought to shore, thinking that they could contaminate the population here, but we've got people coming and going every 5 seconds through the airports.
You spoke about Iowa and how they were having a quick weekend stop the dust. Why haven't they cottoned on to the problem?
Well, years ago I was mentioned in a court case in Dunedin, and I had nothing to do with it, and Judge slated me and all the rest of it. That was published in every paper in New Zealand. But I wasn't asked as a witness. But the person that was slatering me was a representative of the fertilizer company. We took it to the High Court, and they nullified the whole thing and said that Dr. Leshner has been mistreated. Any compensation now will be too little too late, and after 40 pages, I'm sorry, there's no more to cover compensation, so off you go. But that's where the problem is. It's the vested interest. That's where the problem is. And there's massive lobby in Massey and Lincoln of these guys, and you can never solve the problem while they're there. We've got to get it out of their hands before we can solve the problem. You know, it's dumb that we are, we're actually sinners, we're our own worst enemy. That's the problem. I mean, it's a vested interest, that's the problem. And sadly, we haven't been able to pull it away from that.
We need our water consents for the orchard. The interesting thing, the experts were saying that many orchards were overwatering their orchards because they're all desperate to have their unlimited water all the time.
A client in Wakatane, and he was growing shelbelt trees, and he watered them every day, twice a day, and all of a sudden started ring barking them. I said, "Oh, can you turn the tap off?" He said, "Why is that?" I said, "Because every time that the Kelvin cycle starts to come right, you put more water in and just block it off again." So I said, "Those sugars are accumulating in that bark. That's why the black beetles come in. You turn it off and do it once a week, no black beetle. So you can overwater there." Too much water is not good for whiskey either, is it?
In an ideal situation, ideally, how would you do, like, sort of, I guess, sustainable farming? Like, if you had your way?
Oh, well, I'd do a test first, find out what was wrong with it first. Another thing is, because we evolved with no animals, we've compacted our soil back. And then sometimes you've got to break it open, because your phosphate is taken up as H2PO5. Four atoms of oxygen on a phosphate, your nitrate, NO3, is four atoms of oxygen on a nitrogen. Sulfate is SO4, so you've got four atoms of oxygen on a sulfur. So that oxygen is just as critical. But you can't, there's no more shortcut. And when I come back from America, my ex fell in love with someone else while I was over there. However, she said, "What's the balanced fertilizer?" I said, "I wouldn't have a clue." She said, "7 years studying, you can't tell what balanced fertilizer. You show me a balanced soil and I'll tell you. Nothing." So it really depends what's wrong with your soil, but there's no way. I mean, I wouldn't have $500,000 invested in labour equipment if I thought there's a way of guessing it. I'm sorry. I'd love to be able to. But we'd help you. Dexter can help us.
Thank you, guys. I can't thank you enough for coming. I know the subject is so big. This could go on for weeks and months. I've been to Peter's laboratories in Waipawa, And Peter just said, really, it's very easy. All they have to do is send us their sample of soil. And I thought, what a wonderful, simple, but how complex business it all is. But if you want a bit of land, get your soil tested first. Thank you.